Who knows what 2017 holds for cinema? But if it fulfills the promise shown with the releases on its very first day, then we're in for an absolute cracker. I'm Edith Bowman, and you're listening to my weekly podcast, Soundtracking. If you're new to the show, the premise is simple. I speak to filmmakers about the music in their work with relevant examples of the compositions we discuss weaved into the conversation. In this instance, my guest is Juan Antonio Bayona, or JA for short. Since 2007, the Spanish director has made three critically acclaimed movies, all of which have had, in very different ways, children at the centre of the narrative. First came his superior horror flick, The Orphanage, followed by The Impossible, which is about a family caught up in the 2004 tsunami and was inspired by true events. Now he brings us A Monster Calls, based on the award-winning fantasy novel by Patrick Ness. It tells the story of a boy who comes to terms with the terminal illness of his mother with the help of a humanoid tree. It stars Sigourney Weaver, Felicity Jones, Toby Kebbell, Lewis McDougall and Liam Neeson, and is an incredibly powerful cinematic experience. As with all J.E.'s films, A Monster Calls is scored by Fernando Velasquez, while his foray into television with Penny Dreadful saw him collaborate with Polish composer Abel Korzenowski. But it's with Fernando's work that we begin, and his stripped-back soundscape for this latest picture.
Mr. Bayona, it's an absolute pleasure to chat to you. I'm very much a fan of your films. They tap into emotions that not enough films do for me, so it's a pleasure to chat to you. Can we start with A Monster Calls? I haven't sobbed in a cinema quite like that ever. But you very cleverly weave the music in quite specifically with this film. It's almost quite minimal in a way, and silence seems as important to you in this film as soundscape does. Would you agree?
Yeah. First of all, thank you for your words. I think that the story that Patrick Ness wrote has so many different subject matters, and some of them were quite delicate. It was difficult to find the tone of the film, and the music had to do a lot in finding the tone and be very careful in not adding more than what is already in the story. So we got to the moment talking and working with Fernando Velázquez that music had to be smaller than The Impossible. This is something that it came from the fact that The Impossible takes place in 72 hours and this one takes place in months. So the motion is completely different when you talk in such a different period of such a different period of time. Somehow in The Impossible it was bigger, you know, the way people show their emotions in that situation was overwhelming, you know, and in this case the emotion is all the time hidden, the same way Connor hides the truth.
Can I ask you, what is Connor listening to on his headphones? Anything or nothing? I mean, in my head, sometimes I think it's just he's not listening to anything. It's just his way of being in his own head. And then other times I'm like, maybe he... I don't know, tell me.
Well, there's a lot of leaving gaps in the story so the audience can have their own interpretation of the story. And at the same time, this is why it's quite tricky to do the film. At the same time, you want to make the whole thing accessible. So it's always tricky to find the balance between something accessible and mysterious. It's funny what you're asking me because there is some music in the headphones because we had a song for the film and we struggled to put the song in the film and finally we couldn't really and we put the song in the credits. And he was supposed to be listening to that song, but the truth is that we put the song so loud that you cannot even hear the song in that scene.
Is this the Keane song?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
I want to hand you my heart and let you carry the load. Nobody tells you anything you need to know. I need a friend, but a friend is so hard to find. I need an answer, but I'm always one step behind. Guess it takes time learning to fly. Do you ever feel like all you want?
Talk about that for a second because it's beautiful. I know you've got history with the band and working with them and being a fan of them. Did you approach them and specifically ask them to create something?
Yeah, I thought that the story is so dramatic that I needed something that will remind us that Connor is a kid. That Connor, apart from all what he's going through in the story, he was a kid. So I thought that we needed a moment of light. Ultimately, we had that moment in the film because you can see a montage where he stays alone at his grandmother's house and he starts to draw. And it's kind of like a beautiful moment where you can see that he really is a kid. But as much as we struggled in finding the song, we realized that there was no space for the song in the film, so you can hear the song, which is a beautiful song, in the title credits.
What did you ask of them?
I wanted a song that somehow felt nostalgic and at the same time bring light to the story. There was a beautiful song that I love from them called Sobering Light Cafe, and I wanted something like that, in that vein.
I'm going back to a time when we owned this town.
With Fernando, when you've worked with him over a number of films, there's a relationship there and I guess a trust and almost a kind of sixth sense in a way. But with this film in particular, at what point is he part of the process? Is he there whilst you're making the film, before you're making the film? At what point do you bring him in to think about music?
I think because it's a very collaborative effort every time we do a film together, Fernando and I. Not just Fernando, Bernat Villaplana, one of the editors.
Yeah.
He's also a musician, so he brings a lot of feedback in the process. And it was quite tricky to find the right tone for this film, not talking only about the score, but finding the tone and the right architecture of the story. So we start to work with Fernando very early on. Somehow the process always starts with finding the right melody, and for me that's kind of important because the melody somehow tells you about the story in a way you cannot express with words.
Yeah.
And makes it very different. I give a lot of briefing to Fernando about what is the story and what is the tone and what is the meaning of the story to me and what are the emotions we're playing with. And then we start to find the melody. And there is a moment that I said, this is the right one. And from there, we start to work on the score.
Is it easy to decide on when silence is important as well, kind of on the flip side of that? Is that an easy thing to know when that's as important as a piece of score being there?
I think the biggest challenge in this film was to find where to play music, where to put music and where not to use music. And I think that because we were not adding anything more to what was already in the story or the performance, we came to this moment that the most effective or the most emotional moments in the story are in full silence. You cannot hear a single note of music, which makes the music, when it shows up, much more effective.
It almost like sucks your breath out of you when you kind of get that instant kind of...
We had this idea of death being emptiness in the story. And there is a moment when finally you have the moment of death, that the whole screen is black. There's not even a single sound in the film. And I think that was very impressive because there's not many chances nowadays to do a moment where half of the screen is black and you cannot hear not even a single moment of atmosphere, not a single sound.
Yeah.
But then I remember that when we did the last scene, that it had to be music because the music brings a different concept of what you're seeing. There's a relief. There's a moment of peace at the end. And that had to be added with the music. Somehow the music brings a different meaning to what you're seeing, and that's when music is very effective.
Can I go back to the orphanage and music? Because, you know, I have that wondrous thing of reminding myself of these wonderful scores that have been part of your films. And the orphanage, you know, I remember seeing that film for the first time and what a film. Can you talk a little bit about the music in the orphanage and how that was put together?
I think there was an idea of childhood. There was this idea of beauty related to childhood that I think we stole from, I remember, To Kill a Mockingbird, Elmer Bernstein's score, and that was taken from that film. And it's funny because you can see that the poster for To Kill a Mockingbird in the last scene of this film, and somehow there's lots of references to. The other reference I will use would be Georges Delerue and his score for Our Mother's House. I think it's another excellent film about childhood. And I think that there's this idea of childhood being this kind of like desert island, you know, like this paradise, lost paradise, you know.
But the score is this beautiful thing that kind of has these sharp shifts in tone from a note to note in a way that it kind of almost like just drops you off a cliff. It's lovely hearing your reference points as well in terms of the things that influenced you, because is it Barcelona that you were born and grew up in? And,
yeah.
And in terms of what films inspired you and you grew up watching and the moments that you remember those scores coming through, I mean, you mentioned a couple there. Are there any others that really stood out for you of being that moment that you recognised and appreciated how important the music is with cinema?
I think that there are films in particular, and then there are directors. I think what I was more inspired is to discover a generation of filmmakers that took childhood very seriously. And I'm talking about Jack Clayton, for example. You can have Our Mother's House, but you can also talk about The Innocents, and both are very interesting films about childhood.
They ever return to possess the living.
You can see. You must.
The Innocents, produced and directed by Jack Clayton, the man who directed Room at the Top, turned into fearful reality by the magnificent performance of Miss Deborah Carr.
Do they ever return to possess the living?
And when did you first see and hear of such things?
Where? I made them up. Shall I tell you who taught them to you?
I won't ever again, I promise.
Shall I tell you who taught you? The things you've done, the things you've said? Shall I tell you his name?
Perhaps the most controversial concept in human relationships ever presented on the screen. With one of the world's great stars, from the man who directed Room at the Top, a new and adult motion picture experience.
And there's Steven Spielberg, of course, and then there is François Truffaut, of course, and that is where you will find the reference to Georges Delerue.
Ils font l'amour aux quatre vents, tous les enfants du monde, croquant la vie, la belle dent, comme une pomme ronde. Premier baiser, bonheur, chagrin, garde mon cœur, donne ta main. Ça finit mal, ça finit bien, tendre et cruel sont les enfants. Quand deux par deux sur les chemins, ils vont chanter l'amour à 20 ans.
So I think what I was more attracted to was portraying childhood in a, such a meaningful way.
Taking kids seriously.
Taking kids seriously, which is actually what Patrick Ness did in his book.
And allowing children that honesty of dealing with horrendous situations in a true and honest way. So that's what I love about the relationship between Connor and the monster, you know, when he says, speak your truth.
I think somehow these horrendous situations trigger the moment of telling the truth. It's all about restraining the truth. The moment you finally say the truth, it becomes cathartic.
How does the story begin?
With a boy. Too old to be a kid.
You're coming to live with me. Don't touch anything.
Too young to be a man.
I no longer see you.
What did he do?
What you can find also in The Impossible, you know, it's these characters that they discover that there's no survival in lying, so they are forced to tell the truth, and truth becomes something very cathartic to them, and this is actually the subject matter of Patrick Ness's book.
Your cast in this film as well, I have to say, are just perfection. Lewis is so great. I mean, and anybody would really want to have Sigourney Weaver as their grandma. You're going to win in any situation if you have Sigourney Weaver as your grandma. Toby is the father, and Felicity, what a beautiful performance.
It's great you mentioned Toby, because I think he had the most complicated character, because he had to be this father, this character so likable, but what he's doing at the end is so unlikable. So every character deals with a contradiction. You have Sigourney, she's playing like this evil witch for Connor, but at the same time she's playing the mother for Felicity.
Yeah.
So every character was kind of tricky. The monster, again, is... It's a monster, but at the same time, it's the best friend or the solution for Connor. So every character had this contradiction that makes them very interesting.
I have come to get you, Connor O'Malley. Why don't you run, Connor O'Malley? Why don't you run for your mother? Visit you again on further nights, Connor O'Malley, and I will shake your walls until you wake, and then I will tell you 3 stories.
You're going to tell me stories?
I am. I will tell you 3 stories, and when I finish my stories, you will tell me a fourth.
I don't know anything about stories.
You will tell me a fourth, and it will be the truth.
What are you talking about?
This truth that you hide, the truth you dream, you will tell me your nightmare.
No.
Yes, that will be your truth.
I love the development of those characters as the film goes through as well. And I imagine Toby being a brilliant help to Lewis. You know, I remember watching Toby in Dead Man's Shoes and just being completely blown away by that performance.
Yeah, though I didn't want them to spend much time together. Because when you start with to work with an actor, to prepare a character, it's very important the way you design the work you do before the shooting. You need to establish a relationship between the characters.
Yeah.
So, for example, with Felicity and Lewis, we spend a lot of time together before we shoot the film. Apart from rehearsals, we did visits to, I remember, an amusement park, to the movies, to the swimming pool. So they spend a lot of time together because we had to create that bond. world, but with Louis and Toby, I didn't want them to have a
no
relation
contact.
At all. I didn't want them to have contact. So we didn't do rehearsals, and I wanted to keep that sense of awkwardness the first time they were together in front of the screen. At the end, it was kind of impossible because Toby's such a nice guy that they came along very well.
Yeah.
But basically, the first time you see them in front of the camera, it was one of the first moments they were in front of the camera.
Wow.
And you somehow, as a director, are able to capture that with your camera, and that is great.
How did you work that then with relation to Lewis's character Connor and the monster?
Well, that's a very interesting question. We did the whole motion capture. That was 2 weeks of shooting motion capture with Liam Neeson. That was right before we started principal photography. So before starting to work with Lewis and the real shooting, we spent 2 weeks with Liam. So Liam playing the monster, he had someone in front of him. So he was always to play always in front of Lewis, and Lewis had that experience that he bring with himself to the set.
You mentioned The Impossible, and that main theme for that film is so beautiful. I could listen to it on repeat. Where did you start with the music for The Impossible? Because you mentioned earlier about it had to be big, it had to be overpowered in a way in terms of the subject matter.
Somehow it was it had to be a main theme that somehow overwhelms the characters. So it had to be epic in a way that you can feel how big was the whole situation. And it had to deal a lot with frustration and sacrifice. For me, that main theme was the way of showing how the character were overwhelmed by the situation and frustrated. It's funny when we talk about fantasy and reality in The Monster Calls, because I see a lot of that also in The Impossible, which is a story based upon a real story. But I think it also talks about fantasy in terms of this family living a fantasy world. They are Westerners from a Western country going to Thailand and discovering what life is about and discovering what really life is about and how privileged they are. And when they need to go back to their fantasy world, they don't feel the same anymore. And they can feel how privilege deals a lot also with suffering. So we had to deal that level of frustration, of level of discovering how uncertain could be life.
I wanted to ask you as well about the difference between working in TV and film, because Penny Dreadful, you did a couple of episodes of that, and working with Abel. Did you do the first two episodes of that? So you went in and you started the ball rolling, so to speak, and I guess you were very much part of creating that soundscape that then went on for the rest of that series. Was it a different approach?
Not really, because I never thought about Penny Dreadful as a TV show. For me, it was like doing another film. So the way we shot the story, the way we planned the story, was exactly the same if that would have been a film.
Thank you.
And it's funny that the actors, they realized, they came to me and said, this is not like shooting a TV show. And I didn't know what was the meaning, what did they mean saying that. But the truth is that I never thought about that as a TV show. And the score was exactly the same. Funny that we had a different composer for the show, and you know Eva Green, she's a music film lover too.
Oh wow, okay.
So we did a lot of rehearsals listening to music, because I normally shoot playing music all the time.
Do you?
Yeah. So I was playing a lot of Abel music doing rehearsals with her, and I discovered that she was a big fan of Abel too. And she loved Abel too. So the moment finally with the other composer who was supposed to be the one working at Penny Warfield say no, it was obvious that it had to be Abel, because we were playing all these things with his music. So I suggested to the producer, why don't we call this guy that it seems that it has the right tone for the show? And it worked really well. And he spent three seasons doing the scoring amazingly.
That's great. I just heard his score for Nocturnal Animals as well is absolutely amazing. What do you play on set then?
Sometimes it's difficult because there's something beautiful about film music, is that when film music can explain things that you cannot express with words. So this is when you use music. So a lot of times you can find yourself in the set and you just play a music and the actors, they know what you mean. Not only the actors, but the whole crew, the music helps them to focus in what's in front of the camera. And it creates such a special environment that it's helpful not just for the actors, but for everyone. So I like to do it. The other day I was reading about Charlie Chaplin playing music with a live orchestra during the shooting. So it's not something I invented, but it's something very useful in order to put everyone, not just the actors, in the mood of what you're doing.
How wonderful would that be, just to have an orchestra in the corner, kind of go, okay, off you go.
Oh my God, that would be awesome.
That's the dream.
Yeah, well, it was a small orchestra, like 3-4 music, not an orchestra.
Still, that's incredible.
I can imagine why he did it.
You're about to inherit one of the most popular theme tunes as well on a project that you're working on, if I'm right in thinking you're doing the next Jurassic Park film, John Williams.
Yeah.
It doesn't get more epic and huge and wonderful and glorious than the Jurassic Park theme tune. Do you have to have it there? Does it have to be part of it? I mean, do you want it part of it?
One thing that I love about the Jurassic movies is that there is music all the time. And it's so difficult nowadays to find a movie that you can play music all the time.
Yeah.
You know, it's very specific. I mean, there's not many. It's Star Wars, Jurassic, I mean, some of the superhero movies maybe, but it's kind of like old-fashioned to have music playing all the time. But these kind of movies, they accept that. And it's great, and I think that not only John Williams, but Michael Giacchino did an amazing work in Jurassic World, and I'm just so excited to be part of it.
Brilliant. Well, listen, congratulations on this, and I can't wait to talk to you in the future again about your films, but that was just wonderful. Thank you very much. Great for your time.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
main theme to Jurassic Park as composed by John Williams, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with J.A. Bayona. A huge thanks to J.A. for taking the time to talk to us. A Monster Calls is on general release around the world now and is a wonderful piece of work. Now you can find the tracks we played during the conversation in the order they appear by heading to edithbowman.com, where you can also catch up with all of our previous episodes, from Ben Wheatley to Andrea Arnold, Derek St. Franz to Richard Linklater. You should find something to suit your tastes. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook and Twitter. We're at Soundtracking UK. And do subscribe to and rate the show on iTunes if you get a moment. Next up is screenwriter and director John McDonagh, whose latest black comedy, War on Everyone, has had critics purring. I look forward to the pleasure of your company then.